Listening to you, RCT experts, for listening.
This is the great.
start.
This is number 48 on the countdown.
Zombie was 9.
We got a great song by Dicky Doo. Picking number 47.
Zombie 100.
You've tuned into Pandemonium, public affairs and ology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on the show are those of participants, not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT affairs, PA at WRCT.org. And now, Pandemonium.
I am Richard Gord, WRCT, and I'm here on a park bench, beautiful summer day,
by
Carnegie Mellon University professor Brian Junker.
Brian, what department are you in?
Hi, Richard. It's good to be here. I'm in the Department of Statistics and Data Science.
Okay. I'm so old that when I went to college, there was no computer science major. There was applied math.
How long has statistics always had its own departments?
No, statistics used to be a part of the math department, and that's generally how statistics departments get started. Eventually, the mathematicians realize they can't talk very well. And so statistics breaks off and forms its own department.
That happened in the late 60s or 70s at Carnegie Mellon.
Okay, well, we're not here to talk about Office politics.
We're talking about lies, damn lies.
Statistics.
Oh man, you really like to offend statisticians, don't you?
Well, you know. Ever since I was a kid, reading Mad magazine and stuff, I remember there was one joke about chocolate. And one of the points was. How much protein was in chocolate?
There was this stat about this enormous amount of protein.
But then there was an asterisk noting the gargantuan amount of chocolate you have to eat. I think that's everybody's sort of the layperson's appreciation. It's like people tell their own stories, making things up, the numbers.
Right, absolutely true. In fact, for the last 30, 40 years, there's been a strong movement toward increasing numeracy for the layperson, just like literacy being an issue. Information from the public schools and things like that. But I will say that once you become a little bit afraid of numbers and can interpret them, what you realize is all those lies and damn lies are equally telling numbers and language. I mean, open the newspaper, look at what's in the newspaper written in English. Listen to your favorite news channel you hate. And listen to what they have to say with no numbers at all. They're equally capable. So it's just learning another language, like learning French or German or Chinese.
People can do so many different things with the quotes you add up on your website from CH Combs with information assumptions. And those assumptions show up in the numbers that we hear in the news.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I actually refound that myself. I wanted to make sure to bring it up in our talk today. It's one of my favorite aphorisms, really is. Assumptions are really important. What you can collect in the real world, you collect data without any context or interpretation. And the way you convert data into information, first of all, is organizing it, and organizing it requires some sort of know what you're looking for when you're organizing data. And then to actually use that information in some useful way, trying to make a prediction about the future. And the only way to do that is to make assumptions about how the data was generated and how it will happen in the future. So you have to have raw information.
You have to have assumptions, combine them.
And that's how you get knowledge and prediction. If you have the wrong assumptions or assumptions that don't fit very well, you make terrible inferences, terrible predictions of what's going to happen in the future.
That's one of the things that as a statistician, you help your students understand.
Absolutely. I think my specialty and the specialty of a lot of statisticians and statistical models really mathematical formulations, assumptions that you need to understand how the data how to make predictions, and that's what we teach. That's a part of what we teach in the Department of Statistics and Data Science, is how to build those models, how to use those assumptions. Whether you're trying to select the best football player to recruit as dealers, or you're trying to predict the efficacy of COVID vaccines or whatever, all a combination of fact and models.
Or people my age trying to make retirement savings last.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that also is a matter of prediction, making assumptions of what's going to happen in the economy. Should I take my investments out of high yield, high risk product, put them in something safe, or will I go with the assumption that the economy is going to grow for a while first?
We're talking with Brian Junker, Carnegie Mellon. Department of Statistics and Data Science. And one of the things that has led me to talk to you, Brian, is seeing how much numbers are part of the story, Republicans, Democrats, different countries, and it's all part of the story they're trying to sell to the consumer, the reader of the news, the watcher of the TV.
Well, absolutely. And I think, historically, Here's a little etymology lesson, if you will. The word statistics derived from the word state. And really, statistics began as a way of organizing data so that governments could better govern, at least in the view of people who were governing. So the earliest statistics had to do with understanding how much farmland, or how much crops were grown, so governments would know how much to tax. And now that has grown, so now we use statistics in the form of summarized data to understand how Congress should be distributed across the states, and so that kind of information, again, whether it's used with good intention or bad, is a central part of government.
Using information, good or bad, you're making it sound Like it's a double-edged sword that anybody can use for any purpose.
Well, that's pretty much true. I mean, tools are tools, and the goodness and the badness is depends on how you use. You can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to hurt someone. It's a hammer either way. And you try to use the hammer for good instead of bad.
How do educational institutions like Carnegie Mellon? How do they use statistics?
You mean the institution itself?
Yes.
So there is an office of institutional research at Carnegie Mellon. It has a slightly fancier name than that, but that's basically the idea.
As many universities have that.
And they are collecting data about students and about departments and about the functioning of the university. Sometimes directly by looking at records of the university anyway, and sometimes by surveys to find out. What students are happy with, worried about, those kinds of surveys, happen happily essentially every year. There's a survey that's given to all incoming freshmen, and then another survey happens at the end of the first year, and then mostly at the department level there are exit surveys for students who are graduating.
What kind of data are they looking for?
Well, those surveys, they're looking mostly for, for example, what students may know or think they know when they come to Carnegie Mellon as freshmen. And the later surveys often are addressed to questions about what the students have learned there at Carnegie Mellon. There may also be questions about things that are not so much knowledge related, kind of experiences of whether they feel comfortable at the university, whether they feel like they can talk about things or other students talk about things. all those kinds of things affect not only the knowledge that's imparted at Carnegie Mellon, but also the atmosphere of Carnegie Mellon. Like most universities, Carnegie Mellon is interested in optimizing both of those things.
Institutional research and data collection. Obviously governments do a lot of that, and then it gets repeated in the media. You see people freaking out about COVID-19 vaccine because this or that factual tidbit that comes out. How does taking a measured statistical approach help someone understand what's going on in a situation, dealing with whether or not to be vaccinated, or those kinds of things?
Well, I think to some extent this is another area that I see becomes really important. And it's not so much being familiar with numbers, after all we all know 10 digits and how they combine to form other numbers. it's really standing something about how experiments are designed to understand how effective a vaccine might be, and I think something like the COVID vaccine, what's important to understand is, among other things, that although the process was accelerated relative to other vaccines. These vaccines that have been so effective, Pfizer, MRNA, and several others, are built on more than a decade of research, and they went the same rigorous process of experimental evaluation every other vaccine that is approved by the U.S. government goes through. And understanding that process, even a little bit, is really helpful in deciding whether you're going to do the vaccine yourself.
You use the term numeracy, which I think in terms of understanding how the numbers are used, one of the things that I know some people are freaking out about is this vaccine is only listed at 75% effective or 92% effective. But they don't go back and look to see if that means even if someone gets a mild case, it counts as a strike against the vaccine in general, overall, it's been reducing the virulence of the outbreak. But people just hear that number, not 100.
Right, well, there are 100 in the world, and that's the other thing that statistics really helpful in helping people understand is that very few things in this world are completely certain. And one of the things that statistics do is develop methods for deciding how certain, uncertain. The good thing about the vaccine, for COVID, for example, is that by and large, they really highly, a number like 2% amazing for a vaccine. Especially when what we're considering is the failures, say the breakthrough infections, are likely greatly ameliorated by the vaccine, by the antibodies that the body builds up against the vaccine.
We're talking with Brian Junker from Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Science. As you're talking about this, how people manipulate numbers a little bit, sort of tell their own story. I think of economics and all the economic models that are built, but they're all built on assumptions.
They certainly are. I mean, I think the thing that economics adds to statistics. Is thinking more carefully, or at least making assumptions about what the value of different outcomes is. And so, we might be thinking about opening up an institution for a year because of COVID. And when you open that institution, there are several possibilities. There are several possible outcomes. One possible outcome is that everything is fine, and there are no infections, and certainly no serious infections. There are some infections, maybe even two serious infections. And each of those carries a benefit or cost. Thinking about the kinds of trade-offs willing to make across the cost and benefits is extremely important.
And one does it explicitly when one walks down the sidewalk or gets in a car and drives somewhere.
There are risks involved in driving a car. But implicitly we calculate the cost of trade-off. Typically, we get in a car and drive, benefits are better than the cost. And the same sort of thing has to happen with a vaccine or with the reopening of an institution or anything like that.
What about governments? I'm enough older than Brian that I can remember. Quote, tornado drills. They were really air raid drills. and sort of living in the height of the Cold War and Khrushchev putting missiles in Cuba. So through my view, it was mostly you call some economy, and that's all you have to do, and now it sort of seems like things are so much more sophisticated that as people fight about biblical things, they're calling up all sorts of numbers to support their point of view.
Well, that's probably true, although I certainly see a lot of name calling in the public square now too, and name calling is much more effective than I'd like it to be. The nice part about numbers is that as long as the numbers come as possible, verify and decide for yourself whether those numbers actually tell the story that this tribe is trying to tell.
But we've got arguments about whether or not elections were stolen and whether or not the data needs to be audited.
Election data typically is audited automatically. As a matter of law, policy, whatever government is responsible for the election. And I think what we are seeing with the political calls for additional audits is not so much an interest in establishing facts. But an interest in raising dust that it's difficult to find the facts. And of course, that's anathema to anyone who has a scientific bent or a statistical bent. After all, we want to know what the actual data is. And our best source for the data is the election data recorded by the jurisdiction and audited by the normal procedures that law and policy allows for.
A lot of states, county does its own audits, and sometimes state secretary of state follow-up.
Absolutely right. And those public servants, although often they're members of the political party, they understand their job essentially neutral with respect to the party. And that's one thing that's missing in the additional audits. That are being called for political reasons. Another thing that's missing is the care with which we normally do an audit and the reliance on standardized procedures for doing an audit. Just like with an experiment, if you don't do the standardized procedures, you can't trust the outcome. And that's true for many of the politically motivated audits as well.
Numerously getting people to understand the numbers really mean. Oh my God! We've seen a 100% increase in this or that, we're going from two to four versus. Oh my God! I've seen a 100% increase in the number from 20,000 to 40,000. What are the kinds of things you think are really important for the American public, students, and anyone listening to the radio, to really be aware of, put numbers that they hear, statistics that they hear, in perspective.
So I think even your example, two to four versus 20,000 to 40,000, raises an issue which which I think is really important to think about whenever we're looking at data.
And that is, what is the practical significance of the claim? How can I figure out what the practical significance of the claim is?
If I can take away whatever emotional context around the claim, in both cases there's a 100% increase. And it may be that one of those claims is made with a great deal of emotion, and the other is not. But what one wants to do is strip away the emotion as much as possible. And think about the underlying factor of two increase.
And think, are those numbers practically important?
Is an increase from two or four as important as an increase from 20,000 to 40,000?
Well, it depends on the context of the numbers and the assumptions that you're going to make about the numbers.
These are the really important numbers. Everyone knows what numbers are.
Figuring out the context, figuring out the assumptions, the important parts.
Yeah, but sometimes people tell you that it's been 100% increase, and it's done to fuel rhetoric, not to increase knowledge.
Sure, absolutely. That's why it's so important to remain intellectually curious. To be curious enough to try to find out about the numbers if those numbers appear to be affecting you in some way.
It's important to have a little lawyering, have a little bit of, let's test to see if this really is going to work.
We're talking Brian Junker, Carnegie Mellon's Department of Statistics and Data Sciences. And since this conversation is on a college radio station, Here's something that I can remember was a big deal back in my days working at the University of Delaware. So Professor Junker, how much should students trust online faculty evaluations?
Oh my gosh, do you have three hours, something like that? Online or offline, any kinds of evaluations of faculty by students. Are essentially just like the reviews you see on TripAdvisor or Yelp or anything else.
They can be useful, it's not that they're entirely useless.
But again, you need to understand the context in which the evaluations are given.
So as a student, you need to be looking for things that will be important to you about that class or that professor.
Sometimes you're interested in an EVA. So if the evaluations say this guy gives a class,
that's great news.
And sometimes you're interested in really understanding the subject. You might be more interested in the evaluation, you know, this guy was really hard, but I understood.
And so you can't look at those evaluations. In a kind of one-dimensional way.
Numbers that come out at the end.
They may or may not be useful, but the text gives you the context.
It seems to be a theme.
Text gives you a context.
It's going to be important to students.
I can remember that I was teaching at off-campus. Professor evaluation sites to see if people either had an axe to grind or who just thought this was like the best thing since sliced deviled eggs.
Sure, actually for that reason it's dangerous to aggregate student evaluations of PBP because again you're aggregating over a group where you don't have control over who's in the group, who's out of the group.
So you may not be able to trust the aggregation very well.
On the other hand, if you through those reviews and see something that speaks to you about that class, professor, in the actual written comments.
You look at the anecdotes, the averages.
Sounds strange for anecdotes to say, but that's the case. We really want to look at the anecdotes, the averages there, the averages are over, you just have no control over.
Brian Junker, I know you primarily play a banjo player. How has statistics informed your musical life?
Well, or is it vice versa?
Oh, the answer is yes. Both ways, my goodness.
So I have to say that rigorous testing assumptions, kind of thinking goes into numeracy and actually comes from some past training on mathematics.
the pattern recognition parts.
All of those things have influenced the way I approach music and the way I think about music.
I will also say, in the reverse, playing music, playing banjo and guitar, little mandolin here and there. That has affected how I teach and how I think about teaching, and actually how I think about talking to colleagues, talking with professional scientists that I might be consulting with, that idea of performance has really affected in ways that I think are positive. The way I interact with students, the way I interact with colleagues and consultants, things like that.
Very interesting answer now that some people will talk about mathematics in Bach. But you're talking about the other side too, how that come back and influence your professional life.
Absolutely, that's one of the really great things about being open to whatever experiences you have, is that experience in one area may well influence and improve experience in another area.
I have to say that's one of the attractive statistics initially, anyway.
One of the metaphors is crossroads in science. in the sense that it establishes a developed mathematical list of assumptions, maybe to solve a problem in one area, like educational testing, and it turns out that the same models, the same assumptions, the same method turns out to be useful in a completely different area, like counting the number of people in the population, or assessing the success of an online tutoring system or something like that.
So the method you use in one area, you bring crossroads, you go out another part of science or policy, discover that the same methods are useful somewhere else.
You have to be open to different experiences.
As you were talking there, you mentioned counting people. And I know my son worked with a census taker one summer. I think it's pretty remarkable, we still try to do a nationwide census, but then there are also questions about its accuracy.
Well, that's true. We do a nationwide census because it's required as part of our constitution. So every 10 years we have to do, and we should do, head count population, and that feeds into things like the apportionment of representatives and lots of other government policies. Accuracy is a really difficult question for the census. There are groups that are reliably undercounted, such as those who are homeless, whose addresses are not well established. And there are groups who are reliably overcounted, such as those who live in homes, maybe between homes. Or somewhere in their winter home during the census taking. And so counting those inaccuracies is an important part of census taking. And actually, it's part of census work, as it has been in the object of a great deal of struggle. One of the reasons for that is that undercounting in particular tends to happen among the part of the population that would be inclined to vote Democratic anyway, and overcounting tends to happen. Conversely, part of the population would be inclined to vote Republican. And so there are political reasons for preferring that either you do or don't account for inaccuracies, and that's been an ongoing legal struggle in this country for quite a long time.
I believe, I say my numbers support me, you say your numbers support you. What's a consumer of the media supposed to do?
You got to get behind the numbers. You got to get to the actual facts. Numbers typically are a summary of the actual facts. So either by digging into the sources that produce the numbers, or by collecting facts, you've got to get behind the numbers to understand where they come from in order to understand
what seems trustworthy.
Brian Junker from the Department of Statistics and Data Science here at Carnegie Mellon. That was a great way to end this conversation. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it a lot. I didn't bring a banjo, but I brought a couple of cars. So maybe after this we can have some fun.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of participants, not necessarily WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Affairs, PA@WRCT.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Back Brothers Pizza, showing support and supporting WRUCT for Pittsburgh. Back Brothers Pizza offers pizza, homemade and well specializing in vegan vegetarian alternatives. Back Brothers Pizza uses no refined sugar sauce, unbleached flour, and stale dough. Back Brothers Pizza is located at 51107 Avenue in the Garfield River, Pittsburgh. For more information, call 412-2662. Back, or visit their website, backbrothers.com. That's 412-2662, 77725, or spakbrothers.com.
Especially during the pandemic.
But free and mental health is available.
Visit benefitscheckup.org to see if you qualify for benefits, pay for food, medicine, utilities, and much more.
Millions of older Americans are getting over $1,000 a year in benefits.
Maybe you can too.
Visit benefitscheckup.org.
Always been their hero.
Growing up, your hero
was always there.
They repaired your first broken heart.
They took care of you when you got sick.
And they sent you each chapter of your life
with advice and lessons
that left you feeling ready to conquer the world.
But with the passing of time, the tables have turned.
And your hero now more than ever.
AARP is here to help you care for your hero.
Find the care guys you need to help.
Please visit AARP.org/caregiving.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
now a word from some of the other shows here on WRCT Pittsburgh. First up is couch dancing. Funky psychedelic electronic music, and at couch dancing DJ Firefly Wednesday afternoon 3 to 5 p.m. on WRCT Pittsburgh. Next up is consolidation. Listen to better music. Consolidation is on Wednesday evenings from 7 to 10. hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in this Sunday evening to Circadian Rhythms. You just heard a track from Adrian Lanker called Dragon Eyes. Before that was Ghost Funk Orchestra with Cost of Living. And the first track of the hour was King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard with People Vultures. For the rest of the hour, we will be playing songs that all have the word dark in the title. Here is Darkness Interlude by the Korean Town Oddity.
It's a dark, 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 dark. Thank you. my own cousin had a guy. When you talk me, 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 you tal